Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 12th of March, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll find out about a healing art event with guests Sarah Newsom from Aware and also Mark Halpert from Aware. Susan Cable will be giving us a preview of a talk on gardening on raised beds and low tunnels this Wednesday. And I'll be interviewing comedian Paula Poundstone appearing Thursday at Centennial Hall, and we'll find out about student homelessness. It's coming up on a Juneau afternoon with writers Almanac and Birdnote and more. The forecast for tonight looks like mostly cloudy skies with low temperatures 22 to 28 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow showers in the afternoon and high temperatures around 35 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Department of Energy Secretary Stephen Chu has responded to a letter from Wyoming Governor Matt Mead regarding uranium contamination on the Wind River Reservation. Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Autone reports.
Governor Mead expressed concern about leaving the contaminated site to clean itself, as the DOE claimed it would do naturally after 100 years, and said the DOE, the state, and the tribes would all need to work more closely to deal with the site. Secretary Chu agreed with both concerns, adding that the department has planned additional evaluation to protect human and environmental health. And although the site is under federal jurisdiction, Governor Mead says Wyoming should remain involved as it affects the health and welfare of the state's citizens.
I don't know where it's going to go, but I know we're going to keep on that and see if we can come to an agreement with the tribes, the Department of Energy, and the state to make sure that we're headed in the right direction.
A report by the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Geological Survey is expected to be released in May, assessing the DOE's 100-year cleanup plan. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
A South Dakota art museum is beginning a new exhibit featuring a renowned Native artist. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Oscar Howe was born on South Dakota's Crow Creek Reservation in 1915 and spent his life as an internationally known artist. He also spent a quarter century on the faculty of the University of South Dakota. An on-campus gallery bearing his name displays some of his important paintings. Howe is credited by art experts with bridging the gap between Native American and Euro-American cultures. This spring, the South Dakota Art Museum at Brookings will feature a display of Howe's pieces, along with game piece artifacts from the early 1900s. Paintings at the display are on loan from the University of South Dakota, the Howe family, and the State Historical Society. The exhibit is open through May 20th. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
A longtime leader of a California tribe has died. Richard Milanovich passed away over the weekend after battling cancer. He served as chairman of the Agua Caliente Band of Cahuilla Indians for nearly three decades. The tribe says under his leadership, the tribe developed economically, politically, and culturally. The tribe is located in Palm Springs with more than 32,000 acres of reservation land. It operates golf courses, resorts, casinos, and a canyon preserve. National Indian Education Association Executive Director Colin Kippen is speaking about Native education issues today in New York City. The address is part of the National Judicial Leadership Summit on School Justice Partnerships. This week's summit focuses on building partnerships between courts, law enforcement, schools, and communities to work together to increase graduation rates while decreasing school suspensions, expulsions, and arrests. NIEA will focus on culturally based education to nurture American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian students. First Nations and commercial fishing and tourism representatives are outlining their concerns over a proposed pipeline project in Canada. They're hosting a panel discussion in Ottawa tonight. The proposed Enbridge project would carry crude oil from Alberta to British Columbia and then be shipped by ocean tankers to ports worldwide. First Nation Chief Jackie Thomas is expected to speak. She represents a group of five First Nations in British Columbia. Opponents are concerned about fish routes and possible oil spills. During this month in 2011, an honoring ceremony was held for the first South Dakota Secretary of Tribal Relations, Leroy LaPlante. The Cheyenne River Sioux tribal member was named to the post to foster a better working relationship with the state and nine tribes within its borders. South Dakota Governor Dennis Dugard created the cabinet-level position after taking office last year. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
National Native News is made possible with support from Days Inn of Anchorage. Wake up with the sun on the web at daysinalaska.com. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC, CLIC, GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guests are Sarah Newsham from Aware and also from Aware, Mark Calvert. To talk about first a healing art event and then the other activities that are coming up this month. Sarah and Mark, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having us.
So first of all, let's talk about healing art.
All right. It's going to be happening on Tuesday, tomorrow, and Wednesday, so that's March 13th and 14th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. We're hosting it at the Canvas, and it's really an open studio time for people to come together and create art to prepare for Sexual Assault Awareness Month, which is in April. And then we're going to display the art at Bee's Bistro and have a First Friday opening there.
What do you mean by healing art?
Sexual assault, it happens nationally to 1 in 5 women. And then in Juneau, surveys have been done where 1 in 3 women experience sexual violence here. And the healing art, it's a time for either individuals to come if they want to express some kind of healing, or even just as members of the community where such things happen to express some healing there. And in past years, this is our 4th annual one, people have expressed creatively maybe their hope for future relationships, or maybe they've expressed something where they need healing in that. But it's really any kind of art forms. We'll have stuff for collages, for paintings, for poetry, and it's whatever comes out and whatever healing that you as an individual or you think that we need as a community need to express.
Mm-hmm. And other events coming up?
There are other events coming up. In regards to for April, for Sexual Assault Awareness Month, there's going to be a Governor's March, and that is going to be on March 29th. It's a Thursday at noon, and that's the Governor's Choose Respect March. And it's happening all over Alaska. There's actually 114 communities who are participating or hosting their own march. And in Juneau, it's on the 29th at noon, and it starts at the Capitol steps, and then we'll be processing down the streets down to Marine Park. So that's a great opportunity if you want to really get started for April, for Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And then we have some other activities coming up as well. There's going to be our spring advocacy training, and that's where it's a 40-hour training to talk about their discussions and presentations about domestic violence, about the history and the foundation of domestic violence, about sexual assault, and it explores advocacy and accountability, and it's all over our culture. And then if that's something that you're interested in learning more about or exploring, you can give me a call at Aware. And that number, it's 586-6623.
You're the volunteer coordinator there?
I am.
But how many volunteers do you have?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many volunteers doing so many different things. I just started, so I'd say I've met about 20 of them, but I know that there's more volunteers, and there's always people who are coming in to do new things. So this advocacy training, it's a great start if you're interested in volunteering at Aware, if you're a partner agency and that you work with people who have experienced domestic violence, if you just want to increase your knowledge of what's going on, it's a great, great start for that.
And that phone number is 586-6623.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And Mark Calvert, you're also in the studio to talk about activities coming up.
I am. Mm-hmm. I am. I'm part of the prevention team over at AWARE. And it's a really, it's a fairly new area to AWARE, where it's been around for quite a while. And one of the really significant things that's been going on in Alaska for the past decade is that it's become apparent that we really need to take a prevention stance against domestic violence and sexual assault. And more specifically, we need to engage men in this effort, because it's not just a women's movement, it's a men's movement as well. So what my job is at AWARE is to engage boys and men in this effort. And we do it through a number of different ways. One of the things that's coming up that's really interesting is on March 22nd, we're having a coaching boys into men training. And what that is, it's a mentoring program between coaches and teenage male athletes. And it's a curriculum they implement throughout their sports seasons. This is what Coach John Blasco has done at Thunder Mountain High School this past year. And it teaches boys to have healthy respect for themselves, healthy respect for girls, setting good boundaries, having good self-esteem. That training is going to be from 5:30 to 8:30 on Thursday, March 22nd at Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority. We also have something we're calling man training, which is coming up on April 3rd. And what that really is, it's from 5:30 to 8:30 as well at Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority. And it's a time for men from around the community to come together and see this entire movement, to recognize it from a man's point of view, and then also see it from a woman's point of view. And we'll be examining that, looking at everything from media messaging to areas of power and control, and it should be a very interesting evening. Dinner's provided, of course. And then one really cool activity that's coming up is actually this weekend, and that's called the Choose Respect Youth Leadership Retreat. And it's going to be Saturday and Sunday, and we're looking for teenage youth anywhere from 9th grade to 12th grade to come on out and spend the weekend. And one of the interesting things that's going to be going on is they're going to be creating a When I'm an Elder commercial. So we're specifically looking for Alaska Native youth as well. The commercials are really beautiful testaments from youth all over Alaska saying, when I am an elder, this is what I want to see the world like. So that's going to be a real focus for the weekend. And if you're interested in any of these activities, you can call the AWARE Prevention Office at 586-6610.
All right, a lot of activities going on in relation to sexual assault in Awareness Month. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I think that covers it.
I think that
Well, for the next 2 weeks at least, we'll be having a lot more activities coming up in April in honor of Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So if you keep your eyes peeled for flyers and your ear on the radio, you'll be able to hear more about what's coming up.
And we're sure to have you as guests on a Juno afternoon, I'm sure.
Yeah, hopefully.
All right, thank you, Sarah Newsham and Mark Calvert, for coming by.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
2017, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Susan Cable from the Brown Master Gardeners here to talk about a brown bag lunch going on this next Wednesday at 12:05 at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. Susan Cable, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having me here, Jeff.
First, tell me about the Master Gardeners, if you could, please.
Well, the Master Gardeners are a volunteer group that is sort of an arm of the Extension Office and helps disseminate the knowledge that the university researches and publishes. So that's part of our we're trained. We go through 40 hours of training and then actually 72 hours of training and then put in a bunch of volunteer time.
And this Wednesday about noon is going to be a lecture on raised beds and low tunnels. You want to tell me about raised beds and low tunnels, please?
Raised beds are generally made out of wood, but they can also just be the earth piled up. In Southeast, it seems to work best with all our rain to use wood to hold the sides up for limited space. Some people also use stone. The idea of getting the beds raised up is to keep them out of some of the wetter conditions, and also it allows the soil to warm up a lot more quickly in the springtime, which is important for extending our very short growing season.
So when you say raised beds, how high are they raised?
Generally, 8 inches is enough, and that's about a good size for a piece of lumber, too. But some people raise them up quite a bit higher to make them easier to bend over. Of course, the higher you make them, the more soil you need to come up with, and soil is a fairly limited resource around here.
Would you call this a high-tech system?
I would consider it to be a low-tech system.
Yeah. So how much would it cost to set it up?
Well, it depends on how good of a scavenger you are to some degree. I've seen people do it for free if they're able to scavenge the wood, find it floating, have it around from something else, or use a basic material like rocks. And then the soil can actually be quite a bit more of an expense. If you buy it directly from someone supplying it, it can be quite expensive. If you make your own from composted materials, gather wood shavings, things like that, it can be a lot lower expense, but more time consuming and more labor consumptive, of course.
And what kind of things do you grow?
Well, I like to grow food, but people also use raised beds for ornamental gardens. Some people put perennials in them. They can be a little bit more trouble for perennials because the roots thaw and freeze more, and that's harder on the plants. But for annual ornamentals, they're exceptionally good, and also for annual greens and other food crops.
What do you mean by low tunnels?
Low tunnel, we mean that as opposed to a high tunnel, which is more like a greenhouse. A low tunnel, you can't usually walk inside of it. It's maybe waist high. You see them in town quite a bit in the smaller gardens. Usually people have hoops made out of PVC pipe with some kind of clear plastic stretched over it. And it holds in the warmth that keeps off the rain, because too much rain can rinse the nutrients out of the soil.
And this is for ornamentals as well as food?
Yes, it is. Thing about ornamentals is if you've got that low tunnel on top of there, you're not going to see them quite as much. But if you're trying to raise cut flowers for your table or to give to friends, that would be perfect for ornamentals.
Is this something you put on for a little while and then expose it to the sunshine when the sunshine finally comes?
That's a good idea, yes, if you do have the sunshine. I've also occasionally taken my cover off when it does need rain, because with the bed raised up against the ground level, unless it's in a very saturated spot, the soil can dry out pretty quickly. And I know at the end of last spring we had a long dry season, and I was trying to harvest rain off the roof. It wasn't raining, and when it did finally rain, I tried to take the cover off and let some get directly in the garden. It also helps the soil be healthier if it gets more air and exposure to the elements.
I'm talking to Susan Cable about a series of Master Gardener Brown Bag Lunches. This next one is coming up this next Wednesday. Starts at 12:05. You could start it exactly at 12:05.
We generally do start exactly at 12:05. We have people coming from their lunch periods downtown, and we like to make it convenient for them, not keep them too long.
Is there any cost?
There is no cost. It's completely free, and it's been well attended, too. Lots of people there.
How can people find out more information about upcoming classes?
They can go to our website at secakmg.org, that's southeastalaskamastergardeners.org, or they can also call the Extension Office at 796-6221.
All right, Susan Cable, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Not in particular. If you look at our website, you'll see other events we have coming up, too.
All right, thank you very much for coming down.
Thanks, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac from Monday. It's the 12th of March, 2012. It's the centennial of the Girl Scouts in this country. Juliet Gordon Lowe of Savannah, Georgia, came back from a trip to England where she heard about the Boy Scouts, and the Girl Guides came back to Savannah, formed the first troop. 18 girls. It's the birthday of Jack Kerouac, born Lowell, Massachusetts, 1922, French-speaking Quebecois parents. He was a football star, went to Columbia on a football scholarship, and there he met Allen Ginsberg, William S. Burroughs, and Neil Cassady. Jack Kerouac idolized Neil Cassady, and he typed up the story of their cross-country adventures on a single scroll of paper 120 feet long, published in 1957 as On the Road. He depicts Neil Cassady, whom he calls Dean Moriarty, as a charismatic, bad boy American hero. It's the birthday of the playwright Edward Albee, born Washington, D.C., 1928, adopted at the age of 2 weeks by Mr. and Mrs. Reed Albee of Larchmont, New York, of the Albee Theater-owning family. They expected their son to go into business. He wanted to be a writer. He had a falling out with them when he was 20, moved to Greenwich Village, never spoke to his father again, didn't speak to his mother for 17 years. Wrote his first play, The Zoo Story, when he was 30, and 4 years later, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? It was his first Broadway play, produced in 1962, and a runaway hit. It's the birthday of the poet and author Naomi Shihab Nye, born in St. Louis, 1952. Father Palestinian, her mother American. Nye grew up in St. Louis, Ramallah, Jerusalem, and San Antonio, where she lives today. Her latest book, a collection of short stories, There Is No Long Distance Now. Naomi Shihab Nye, who said, "Poetry calls us to pause. There is so much we overlook while the abundance around us continues to shimmer on its own." It's the birthday of Carl Hiaasen, born Plantation, Florida, 1953, columnist for the Miami Herald, novelist, and his young adult novel, Hoot, won the Newbery Award in 2002. His new young adult novel, Chomp, due out later this month. It's the birthday of Dave Eggers, Boston, 1970, grew up in Lake Forest, Illinois. When he was a student at the University of Illinois, both of his parents died of cancer within 6 months, and he was on his own at the age of 21. He later said, "On the one hand, you were so completely bewildered that something so surreal and incomprehensible could happen. At the same time, suddenly the limitations or hesitations that you might have imposed on yourself fall away. There's a weird, optimistic recklessness that could easily be construed as nihilism, but is really the opposite. You see that there is a beginning and an end, and that you have only a certain amount of time to act, and you want to get started." He wrote a best-selling book about it, a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. Here's a poem for today by Pat Schneider, entitled River. A delicate fuzz of fog, like mold or moss, all across the river, in this early light. Another day, I might have still been sleeping. What a pity. How the stars and seas and rivers, in their fragile lace of fog, go on without us, morning after morning, year after year, and we disappear. The poem by Pat Schneider, River, from Long Way Home, published by Amherst Writers and Artists Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at constantcontact.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:26, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. I'm honored to have with me as my next guest, calling from Santa Monica, California, is comedian Paula Poundstone, who will be appearing Thursday night at 8 o'clock at Centennial Hall, a concert presented by Marlantini's and a variety of local businesses, including KTUO Juneau. Paula, thank you very much for being on the air with me today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I love the Writer's Almanac.
All right. Well, it's a great program, and the same, you're a great comedian.
Well, I'm in there pitching anyways. I'm really looking forward to coming to Juneau, and it's soon.
It's Thursday at 8 o'clock.
Thursday at 8 o'clock, I'll be there. You know what? Writer's Almanac plays in Los Angeles, I swear, like 4 or 4:30 in the morning, and I can almost guarantee you I will hear it on my way to the airport. That's when I usually hear it, because I have to get up with nature to get all the way to Alaska by Thursday night.
Paul Poundstone, what was it like when you discovered you had the ability to make people not just laugh, but laugh so hard their cheeks hurt?
I don't know if I've discovered quite that. When I was in kindergarten, the first sentence of the last paragraph of my kindergarten teacher's summary letter that she wrote was, I have enjoyed Paula's comments, humorous comments about our activities. That was Mrs. Bump wrote that in May of 1965. So I've been striving to repeat the success ever since.
How did it compare to like having a superpower?
Oh, you know what? If it were never fail, it would be the greatest superpower ever to have. Because, you know, laughter produces endorphins. And so it would be, the power to both uplift and to heal. I can't say that it never fails now, though. You know, so I mean, I think overall I could encourage people to come out because overall it is my experience that it's a good show. But, not like every single thing out of my mouth. What a great superpower to have. I think I might even take that over flying.
You cut your comedic teeth in a variety of cities, Boston, San Francisco, Los Angeles. How did the different cultures in the different cities affect your work?
I think that I don't think it's as different from place to place in terms of the audiences that come to see me as you might think. Each place is, somewhat unique, particularly up in Alaska, I guess. But, the crowds that I work to are all pretty great. My manager is always talking to me about red state and blue state and all that stuff. I got to tell you, it has nothing to do with any of it. I entertain people who've come out to laugh for the night, which is, it's a pretty, pretty great gig. I used to work at the International House of Pancakes, 11 at night to 7 in the morning. So this is really much better.
Did you do comedy there?
I did not. I served, and I was never a very good waitress. I will tell you this: when people would be rude to me, I would touch their eggs. No one seemed to know, and I felt better, and it all worked out.
How do you make something funny that's not particularly funny? How do you find the humor that is in everyday life?
Hold on. I have an alarm clock going off. Believe it or not, I guess it's time to get up. There's no science to it that I know of. I think of stuff that strikes me as funny, and I say it. Sometimes it goes over great. Sometimes it goes over just okay. There's here and there. There's things. The other night I was Missoula, Montana, and I was going the next night to Seattle. And I told the crowd I was only teasing, but I said that I wasn't looking forward to going to Seattle. I was only joking. And I said because I thought that they talked a lot about fish and kites. And for some odd reason, it struck all of us. It was a non sequitur, it was just silly. And somebody wrote me a letter today, and people were laughing, and we were having a good time talking about fish and kites. And then somebody wrote me a letter today, said, gee, I didn't understand the thing about fish and kites. And they said they thought it was because they were 51, and so they didn't understand everything all the time. I wrote back, I said, I'm 52. And so a lot of times I say stuff that makes no sense at all. It just was silly. It was one of those you had to be there things. We were just being silly, which is, that's really a joyous point in the night, actually, when one of those experiences where it's only funny to everyone there at that moment. And I think I have a lot of those, actually. I have really great crowds that come out to see me.
Do you have a pre-show mantra or a routine that you do before every show?
I think I do. I glance at notes for a few seconds. I in a really sloppy way, slap on some red lipstick. And I think I do sort of mentally prepare, although it's not a terribly conscious thing, I mean, I kind of look at notes, but the truth is, everything that I mean to say, I never end up saying. It never sticks in my head long enough. Usually what I do is, my act is largely autobiographical. I talk about raising a house full of kids and animals. I talk about trying to pay enough attention to the news to cast a halfway decent vote, which is not such an easy trick. I talk about the sad, sorry state of broadcast news and that of the public school system. Sometimes I talk about Abraham Lincoln. My favorite part of the night is I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And little biographies of the crowd emerge, and from that I sort of weave, where I'm going to go. And it seems to work pretty good, actually. And so each show is unique, really. None of them are exactly the same. I never have any idea what time it is or, you know, how long I've been on.
You're known for having a stool and a can of Diet Pepsi and just a microphone there. How do you size up an audience to make sure they're ready for your improvisation or jazz style of comedy?
Oh, I just jump off when I feel ready. Sometimes, honestly, from pretty much the moment I go on, and I do drink diet soda on stage, which, by the way, they just found out causes the dye from. Did you hear that? The dye from Pepsi and Coke. They've now determined causes cancer in lab rats, so they're going to change the color of it. That'll be good. I don't know how they get a rat to drink a soda. I had a theory that perhaps it wasn't the soda at all, but rather the little straw that the rats tend to chew on.
Maybe you could be a scientist in your spare time.
Oh, man, I would love to do some of those studies. I really would.
Tell me about performing on television versus in comedy clubs.
Well, I much prefer to be in a theater. I like to have a live audience in front of me. The problem with the television things for me, when I go to one of those late night talk shows, is that you're supposed to do 5 minutes. I have a very hard time doing 5 minutes. Partly because if you're going to do 5 minutes, you need to know what you're going to say, and I just have a really hard time sort of sticking to a even a script that I wrote, sticking to scripted material, because I just like to have the ability to kind of stick and move, and so those are not really my favorite experiences, although I've done them. I've done HBO hours for HBO before, and those work a lot better for me because A, I have more time, and B, I'm not really answering to anybody in terms of what I'm saying, and it makes it better, and I can interact with the audience, which is my favorite part of the night.
How'd you get involved with Wait, Don't Tell Me?
In the most boring of ways, they called me up and asked. I had never heard of the show at that point. This was about probably, I don't know, 11 years ago, 12 years ago. I had a nanny at the time that was familiar with the show, and he said, oh, you should do that. And so I did, and I really enjoyed it. When I first went there, we actually didn't all come together. We were all in different places, just hooked up via telephone wire, and there was no audience in front of us. And although that was, good and effective, I think, to some degree, they eventually stumbled on having everybody be in one place and have an audience in front of us in the theater, and the energy from that is far superior to without. So now we're headquartered in Chicago. I usually we're out of there, and we're in the basement of a bank with a crowd of about 500 in front of us, and it works pretty darn good.
What do you think being on the road all the time does to your comedy?
Well, I've just been reading Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, I think his name is, who says that you have to, the book is about expertise. The book is about excellence and what's the formula for excellence. And one of the figures that he throws out, and he has evidence to back up, is that it takes 10,000 hours to get expert at something. And so working the road's great for me because, it takes a lot of practice. It's not as easy as it looks. I have a huge small shampoo collection, so I got that going for me.
What role does blue material have in your work?
It really depends how you define it. I say the stuff that I think is funny, and it, you know, and it's also, as I said, largely autobiographical. So I don't talk a lot about sex because I don't have sex. And therefore I'd be making it up if I was talking about it. And I prefer the stuff that's real. So I don't really think I do very much that falls into that category exactly. I curse here and there, which a lot of people consider, you know, a horrible thing. I don't. I think the idea that there's words that we can't say is just the silliest idea I've ever heard of. And kind of odd, given that we all know what the words are that we can't say. So that, for example, if one is on television and a word that you can't say got bleeped, well, it may well be a far less offensive word than the word that people think it was. It's kind of silly. Not only that, but twice now in the last couple of years, we've had cases go all the way to the Supreme Court about whether, you know, about the FCC fines and about cursing on television. And I think to myself, that's what we're doing with our Supreme Court? Don't we still have a problem with waterboarding? I mean, it seems to me there's more important issues to be dealt with. But anyways, I do curse here and there, so if it's if that's something that's terribly offensive to somebody, then they definitely shouldn't come.
How much work is your work?
Well, I mean, it is and it isn't. I'm lucky because it's a job that gives me absolute joy. It can be tiring, and yet probably not as tiring as when I bust tables. And I was a really good table busser, by the way. So I don't know. It's, you know, the hardest part is getting there. The hardest part is the logistics and the phone calls and all that stuff. The part of being on stage is just pure icing on the cake.
What comedians do you look up to and maybe get inspiration from?
Let's see. I'm lots, honestly. I love Bob and Ray, the old comedy radio team. I love Lily Tomlin. When I moved out of my parents' house, I stole all 11 of their Bill Cosby albums. I can't believe it's time to get up again. I thought I turned that alarm off, but apparently I didn't. Not very good with technology, I'll be honest with you.
So would you say an older style of comedy is more to your liking than the newer cutting edge stuff?
No, not necessarily. I don't watch stand up anymore. It's not that I wouldn't if it were in front of me, I suppose, but I certainly don't go out to I don't know, a lot of times like people talk to me about people that are coming up now, and honestly, I haven't paid any attention, and so I don't know them. But that's more, product of the fact that I'm really, really busy than necessarily, that I would or wouldn't watch this or that. So the people I tend to be familiar with are the people that I watched a lot when I was younger. I love Lily Tomlin. I love Richard Pryor. I love Dana Carvey and Kevin Nealon, and I like the good people.
I'm talking to Paula Poundstone, who will be appearing Thursday night at 8 o'clock at Centennial Hall, and a concert brought to you by Marlantini's, and percentage of the sales of those tickets go to KTOO, which is cool. What can we expect on Thursday night, Paula?
Well, as I said, I talk mostly about raising a house full of kids and animals. I talk about, sometimes I talk about the Hardy Boys, but only where appropriate. And my favorite part of the night is just talking to the crowd.
All right, Paula Poundstone, thank you very much for being on the show with me today. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Not that I can think of.
All right, we're looking forward to having you in town.
All right, thanks so much. It was nice talking with you.
I love to laugh. I love to giggle from my head to my toes. It makes me feel so good. Now I can be silly and I can be serious, but I love to laugh, oh, every chance I get. Till my knees get weak and I fall down and my thighs ache, and I laugh till I cry and I can't stop, and it's hard to breathe, but the more I laugh, the better I feel. Oh, good. Now I can be silly and I can be serious, but I love to laugh. Hey!
play every chance I get. When it's side splitting and ribs shaking and tummy tickling and happy, making it silly giggling and gut busting, the more I laugh, the better I feel. Oh, 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 oh. I love to laugh. I love to giggle from my head to my toes. It makes me feel so good. Now I can be silly and I can be serious, but I love to laugh every chance I get. So open up wide and let out some sunshine. Share something happy, making it friends and family. It won't cost a penny, or is it when funny story brightens your day and makes you feel so good from your head down to your toes. And chase the blues away. Oh, 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 oh. Just take a breath and stand. Just share a funny story. It'll make you feel so good. Share a funny story. Share a funny story.
Sweet Honey in the Rock. Time is 3:43 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are here to talk about student homelessness. They're from Haifa City. We'll be talking tomorrow at the Wednesday at the State Museum, round bag lunch on student homelessness. It is tomorrow or Wednesday?
It's Wednesday.
It's Wednesday at noon?
Yes.
All right, well, thank you very much for coming down today. Also in the studio is Karen Donovan and Leslie Scranton here to talk about the growing problem of student... Is it a growing problem, I should say? Student homelessness?
In the district,
mm-hmm.
In Juneau, yes. It is an information that it would be relevant for the community to be aware of what the numbers are, what are some of the successes that the program is experiencing, and what are some of the challenges as well.
How widespread is the problem?
I think it's spread throughout the district, all of the schools throughout the district, since that's our focus, is educating students who are homeless, have liaisons in the district to work with our central district office on providing services to our families in transition with homelessness.
I think you mentioned numbers. How can you share some of those numbers with us today?
We currently have close to 200 students, K through 12 grades. And in the last few years, the trend has been increasing.
What are some of the causes?
Most of the causes are level of economic power that families have. The trend is more that there is a parallel between low-income families and the number of homelessness. Another group of the families are those who move new into Juneau, and they're also experiencing a shortage in housing and also low income. So there is a coincidence of two different issues, and they stay at different shelters in the city.
I guess I'm just thinking of couch surfing when I think of a homeless student.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at the high school level. There are lots of students attending Yaku's Takahiti High School. At any given time, about 45% of them are homeless, and what you would refer to as couch surfing, staying with friends, not having a permanent place to be.
What are the kinds of situations are there?
We have students at times who are, you know, staying in cars, staying in a campground, staying with friends, and yet they're coming to school, they're trying to finish their education when they don't really have any other support behind them, and that's how important this program is to us, to help these students continue with their education so that they can find themselves out of this situation.
Could you describe the program, please?
The program provides the basic, we identify the students, and we provide their basic supports, both for, you know, to meet their basic needs, but also their academic needs. The goal is that they would meet the academic standards that is expected of other students as well. So we provide tutoring. We provide after-school programs as well. And we also provide the transportation so that they have access to all of the different programs and services that the school district has readily for the students.
In many cases, is it a matter of choice, or is it something that kids are forced into?
It's not typically a matter of choice. It's typically something that families are forced into due to lack of affordable housing or lack of economic resources to provide shelter for themselves. One of the greatest benefits that I see at the elementary level is the transportation that our program, Families in Transition, can provide to help retain students in their school of origin. So whichever school boundary area they're living in at the beginning of the school year, the goal is to try to keep them in that school all year, even if the family moves around Juneau, bounces from family member to family member, bounces from a family friend's house to another family friend's house. We try to keep our child a child in the original school they enrolled in for that school year for consistency's sake.
How much of a stigma is there for being a homeless student?
Oh, I don't really see much at elementary. I don't think that elementary children are always aware of where others live. Some do, but I don't see that it's quite as stigmatizing at elementary. Karen, high school?
I would say quite a bit. I would say it's a pretty big stigma, because these are young adults who don't have a means to do things differently. So you see them. They do have everything they own in their backpack. They don't always have a place to throw their jacket in the wash. And so sometimes it's very easy to see if somebody is struggling through that. And it is hard for them. And especially when you're a young adult, as we all know, teenagers are very sensitive to what they feel other people think of them. And so when they come to our school, we also have a washer and dryer. We let them wash their clothes there. We help to make sure they have shampoo and deodorant and towels. They'll take showers at different places, the Zach Gordon, and we have one at school. And, those are the kinds of things to help them to get beyond that stigma.
How do the numbers break down versus elementary schools versus high schoolers?
Mm-hmm. Approximately, I would say 60% of our students are in between middle school and high school levels, and the lower numbers are in elementary schools.
Are grades typical casualties?
Pardon me?
Are grades academics considered casualties in this?
They can be, especially in the traditional setting of school. That's why we work at Yakus. We work so hard on giving students an opportunity to work with us according to their schedules and what will work for them. It's very difficult. You come to school, it's extremely cold outside, you spend the evening in a car, and you come because there's shelter in that, but maybe you aren't in the frame of mind to accomplish as much as a student who had a shelter the night before. And we work with students individually on that.
We also, at the elementary, try to get our students enrolled in an after-school homework club so that they can take care of their academic needs while still in the school building. They release out later in the day, and Families in Transition will help provide the transportation home for those kids because they stay an hour beyond the bus when the bus goes.
I'm wondering, is substance abuse a problem, especially in high schoolers?
It can be, yes. As you can imagine, the one making that choice to participate in something like that to sort of forget what's going on with them. So, yes, it can be.
I'm talking with Haifa Siddiqui, Karen Donovan, and also Leslie Scranton about the Families in Transition program in the State Museum. Brown Bag Lunch is held this next Wednesday at the Alaska State Museum. Imagine if people are looking for solutions for homelessness, is this a similar effort being attracted towards solving the problem of student homelessness?
I'm not sure I'm following the question.
Student homelessness being attacked with the same emphasis as regular family homelessness?
I believe that most of the conversation and numbers that are used for, the different information that is provided and all to the public and also to advocate for funding and support addresses families and adults. But I think that it's the numbers when increase greatly when you're addressing how many children there are in each family. So I think that that's the part of the conversation that is not so much in the public mind. We count families or individuals, but it's difficult, not difficult, but at times the number of children is the one that is not included in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Anything like that I might have forgotten to ask? I guess my one of my questions is, what kind of solutions are out there? Seems like you're doing a lot with the Yakuza. They're making washing machines available, but what other things are being done?
You know, I sometimes don't think we are as aware in Juneau of how many young people mm-hmm. that we have that are homeless, who don't have a place of their own. And I think one of the big things and that is really great about the program that we have in the schools, but additionally the brown bag luncheon and those kinds of things, is to help us become more aware so that we can start to work together as a community to sort of help support what are we going to do about that and where are we going to go. This particular family and transitions programs in the schools is a huge start. It's a huge way for us to try to identify who the students are and to help get them on their feet. But there really is a lot of work to do that we have in the community to address the needs as a whole.
What about the national front? Are similar problems being experienced across the country?
It is a problem that is also addressed from the through the federal programs in terms of students. The funding that we use is actually a combination of federal programs as well as district funds. They support the students, as we said, in terms of their transportation and basic needs and academic needs as well. We almost find like there should be more emphasis on the supports for these students. And in the current climate, even at the federal level, those are the first programs that usually suffer when you need to make adjustments in terms of funds for supporting these programs.
If people are interested in helping out but can't make the meeting tomorrow on Wednesday, how can they help?
On Wednesday, we will also present how is the federal government supporting our programs, as well as how we are supporting our students. And there will be an opportunity for the public to ask questions and see what are some of the areas for voluntary work and community services that are available in Juneau.
Is there a phone number you'd like to share for people to contact you if they can make the meeting on Wednesday?
523-1500. That would be the Juneau School District main number. And from there, people can connect directly with the school liaisons, which we have one in every school, and also centrally through the student services.
If anybody would like to gain more information and doesn't have an opportunity to go to the brown bag event on Wednesday at the State Museum at noon, and you're interested in learning more about what's going on with our young adults in the community, we would welcome any conversation or any call that you would like to make to Yakuza. We'd be happy to speak to you. And we do have several people who come and volunteer at our school, and we're always looking for more.
Mm-hmm. Will all three of you be making the presentation on Wednesday, or just you, Hype City?
It will be the three of us. There will be a representation for secondary students and elementary students. And also the state liaison will be there, Kay Holmes.
All right. Thank you very much for coming down. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Thank you very much for having us.
This is Bird Note. If you hear the eerie song of the very thrush, you may be in a moist Pacific Northwest forest, in a quiet and private place. Naturalist and artist Louis Agassiz Fuertes one of the greatest painters of birds, called the Song of the Varied Thrush, as perfectly the voice of the cool, dark, peaceful solitude as could be imagined. At first glance, a varied thrush may appear to be a robin, except in winter, when it gathers in loose flocks to move to lower elevations. This shy bird prefers solitude. The intricate pattern of color on its wings resembles dappled sunlight on the forest floor, and the male has a distinctive black band across his orange breast. Listen carefully to hear the overtones that turn the single sound of a varied thrush into a delicate minor chord. Varied thrushes are not often heard in the urban and suburban habitats of the Puget Sound region today, because the lowland conifer forests cover less than 1% of their original area. BirdNote is grateful to all those who are working to preserve important forest habitat. You can help by using forest-friendly lumber. Find out how at birdnote.org. The choices we all make do matter.
It's just about 3:59, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1 and K220 BT Sarasuna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210 AS 89.9. Also online at www.ktuo.org. Tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon, Pat Moore will be your host. He'll talk with Michelle Elfers and Nancy Long about the upcoming Becoming an Outdoors Woman retreats. Sarah Harkins will be here to highlight the La Leche Lake activities. Eric and Fubao Goldsberry will be here to give us the details on Saturday's St. Baldrick's fundraiser. It's coming up tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with low temperatures around 22 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, snow showers are likely with about 1 inch expected. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy skies with scattered snow showers, low temperatures around 25 degrees. Wednesday, mostly cloudy with high temperatures around 38 degrees. Thank you for tuning in to Juneau Afternoon today, and have a pleasant evening.